When Carrie asked me if I would lead a service this summer, I was hesitant but said, sure. As a new member of the UU Church of Belfast, I was interested in giving back in some small way to a place that had been so welcoming to me. I also appreciated the promise of lower church attendance in summer. Somehow falling flat on one's face seems easier with a smaller audience. After all, I had done this before, meaning lay services, in another UU church not so long ago or far away, in Pittsfield, Maine, where I lived for nearly 30 years. If nothing else, I could dust off an old homily no one here had heard before. UUs definitely being people who appreciate recycling. I immediately ran into a few problems unearthing my old homilies, some practical, some psychological. From a practical standpoint, old homilies either existed on floppy disks, remember those? Or as printouts stored in boxes of writings that would require archaeological excavation. I also recall that some of those services were for special occasions, like Earth Day or Father's Day, that wouldn't resonate in late July. By far, the biggest obstacle was psychological. Was I even the same person I was when I wrote those homilies? I mean, when my daughter was young, attending RE in our UU church, my ex-wife and I happy in our old farmhouse on 43 acres in Pittsfield. And what about the First Universalist Church of Pittsfield and the associated heartbreak there? The church where my wife and I were married. And after our separation, the subsequent embezzlement by a church moderator. He went to jail. The sale of the farmhouse, me moving out, and the subsequent sale of the historic First Universalist Church, where water from the Sebasticook River was originally diverted through a water wheel beneath the church and powered its stately pipe organ. And finally, the church being torn down by a developer. I haven't driven through Pittsfield since. So like many writers, I found that the path of least resistance turned out to be through. Not under, not around, not over, but through. Who am I? Where am I? What's going on? In other words, my contemporary collateral. That sounds simple, but sometimes it's daunting. The breakthrough came when I fell back to what I call my first principles, reminding myself why I like to write, especially poetry. For me, it's about synthesizing my thoughts and making sense of a chaotic world. Some thoughts are profound, some not so profound, like, why did the squirrel cross the road if it wasn't likely to end well? But mostly, I'm always looking for through lines, how far I've traveled across a map, roads taken or not taken, and where I return to. Recently, I wrote a new poem that included a mountain, which presented me with a puzzle. When I wrote this new poem, I thought of two previous poems I'd written and published about mountains. I wondered why these three poems struck me as a trilogy, even though they were written years apart. Then I remembered that not only were they poems with mountains in them, they weren't just about mountains, but about love and nature, with a trickle of spirituality running spring-like down their faces. When the title of this homily came to me, Love, Poetry, and Other Mountains We Climb, I realized how much work I had to do. I'll get to the poem shortly, but first it's important to acknowledge how entangled themes of love and spirituality have been with mountains. For millennia, really. Consider spirituality, which might be the easier association. While it's possible to grow bored hiking a mountain, not many people do, and their thoughts eventually drift away from mundane musings about what Taylor Swift's wedding cake tasted like to deeper peregrinations. The more arduous the hike, the sorer the knees, the deeper the thoughts. And while not every climb lends itself to the seven-story mountain by Catholic theologian Thomas Merton say, it's not uncommon to hear hikers proclaim feeling closer to God in the midst of a magnificent view. Mountains are wonderfully adaptable for different religious practices. They come in different heights and slopes, some more accessible than others, some of them downright cruel with their harsh weather and lack of oxygen. For every Christian who embraces the story of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, others look at a mountain range and see many mounts capable of supporting more than one prophet, one sermon, or one religion. For every fundamentalist Christian who climbs a mountain and views a fiery sunset and thinks about an exclusive afterlife, there's a Unitarian Universalist who climbs a mountain and dances under a rainbow. Depending on the mountain and the weather, it is literally possible to stick one's head in the clouds and be worshipful or not. Love perhaps has a more complicated association with mountains due to the danger of quickly veering off trails into overgrown habitats where the wild clichés live. There are the ups and downs, long, arduous journeys, and for those who have children, small voices asking, are we there yet? Clichés like tree roots are always trying to trip us, which is why I like poetry and its slow, deliberative pace, syllables placed as carefully as steps. The first of my poems I'll read is the oldest, and it's called South Turner Mountain. Happens to be on the screen there. A real place, Baxter State Park, overlooking Sandy Stream Pond that you may have visited before. I fell back into writing poetry seriously in the spring of 2020, only realizing later that I was trying to fathom a marriage that was slowly unraveling, despite the closer proximity the pandemic ironically afforded. During 30-something family trips to Baxter State Park, I had kept detailed journals, often scribbling late into the night to describe our wild adventures, which included camping in Baxter on 9/11 and learning about the horror in New York only when a ranger lowered an American flag at Kidney Pond to half-mast. South Turner Mountain was written about a hike nearly a decade later. I wanted to write South Turner Mountain using my journal as source material because it was my first memory of my wife and I separating, albeit for a short period. A palpable sense that something was off. If you look up from Sandy Stream Pond, one of the most accessible and popular places to view moose in Baxter State Park, South Turner Mountain rises sharply out of the landscape, mostly wooded with a summit of bare, angular rock that looks like a demolished temple. My wife and I hiked the mountain, but short of the peak where the tree line ends, I continued on through the temple's rubble while my wife rested behind, not interested in attaining the summit with me. So this is South Turner Mountain. We told ourselves we could turn back any time. Gazing from the wooded shore of Sandy Stream Pond, the bare rock summit of South Turner Mountain looked like the ruins of a temple. 3,122 feet above sea level, some deity had built a temple, only to see it destroyed by weather. And in that moment, we decided to become pilgrims, to leave a Zen garden of sandy shallows, rippled water, boulders, and yellow birches, and ascend 1,000 feet in 0.2 miles, twisting and squeezing between rows of boulders as though exiting crowded pews. Chorus of black-throated green warblers singing amens as a hermit thrush beckoned us to higher realms. Golden-crowned kinglets chirping reverently as we neared a side trail to a spring, a holy sight burbling out of the bare rock like a miracle as a toad hopped across our path, hoping to find a cure for its leprous appearance, or maybe just seeking baptism over and over in the church of its amphibious youth. So we climbed higher and higher into thinning air, mountain cranberries leading us to tree line, to gardens of bonsai potted in gravel, and we gaped looking up at the ruined temple, still gilded with sunshine, even as shifting spirits darkened and clouded Katahdin. My partner waiting amidst the stunted spruces as I continued my journey onward and upward, the vulnerable meeting the venerable, stepping through the temple's granite stones, blue blazes punctuating the irregular path like blasphemous curses, until I looked down at distant Sandy Stream Pond, where a moose hunched like a priest in dark robes, plume of silt wafting behind like incense, and I descended quickly, weak-kneed in my berth, destined thereafter to climb and decline mountains, seeking enlightenment. And further down the slope, a lone wood frog, shimmering in silky green and black monk's robe, crossed our unsteady path. So high in elevation, it would have to begin its journey down the mountain before autumn deepened, before reincarnation began. And back at Sandy Stream Pond, the priestly moose had disappeared like a savior into the wilderness. So we looked away, then looked at ourselves. The next mountain poem came years later. With marriage counseling, separation, and divorce proceedings tumbling towards their inevitable end like a runaway boulder, I reconnected with a former colleague, a woman who had ascended and descended her own mountains to singledom. She told me that she wouldn't be ready for a relationship for 2 years, so we became the best of friends without pressure. With meals and music concerts, walks along rivers, and comparisons of notes on our 20-something daughters who were finding their respective ways in the world. Then, you guessed it, came the averted gaze and news that she was seeing someone, had thrown her own 2-year rule over a cliff for a new boyfriend who wouldn't understand why I was hanging around like spring snow. Lucky you if you've never been through friendship breakups, which have well-deserved reputations for devastation. Again, my thoughts returned to mountains, and I wrote this next poem, revenge poem, about what it feels like to be sent into the proverbial wilderness. This is a revenge poem. When you started seeing someone and told me to take a hike, I complied, heading for Maine's Mount Blue, chattering along a gravel road to the trailhead where apple trees spilled fruit in an ancient overgrown farm that had lost its view. They worked hard on that farm, but flocked and frolicked during foothill winters, and on the trail American beeches gave way to sugar maples, gave way to white spruces, as I hiked past the ranger cabin where they once diverted water from the nearby ledge falls, and the path abruptly steepened, sidestepping mossy mountains of glacial history, until even the conifers struggled, trees shrugging off burdens of watery weight. And amidst the short crumholes, a view of all emptiness returned, fire tower stairs slick. And when I feel low, I ascend, and when I'm dragged down by someone, I climb high. And in the thin air of 3,000 feet, verse comes quick as breath, words visible and falls cold, as I write a single revenge poem in a leather-bound notebook, electrocardiogram scribbles describing the state of my heart, something like earthquakes, tiny tremors everywhere. I now had two poetic data points about relationships, about mountains. The first poem was obscured by clouds. The second poem more crystalline and colder. What was happening? I thought of the age-old question, why do we climb mountains? And the stock answer, because they're there. But this trope has always seemed deeply unsatisfying to me. No one needs to climb a mountain. It's not really a job for anyone anymore. With the guy wires of abandoned fire towers whistling forlornly in high winds, I thought about how a popular route up Katahdin, Eyebald Trail, had closed abruptly when an ancient rock slide on its upper reach moved 1 year, massive slabs of granite lurching closer to Penobscot Bay. And how, as I got older, the mountains I climbed were getting smaller, me putting in hours of homework as I tried to find the best views for the least effort. Surely geology and biology were conspiring against my hikes, maybe even my journeys. If I wasn't inclined to climb mountains just because they're there, then what hope was there for relationships that weren't there? Why not turn away, foregoing mountains forever, and stare at a blue heaving ocean for the rest of my life? I realize that the answer to why do we climb mountains is similar to the question of why religion. While many people forego spirituality or religion with ease, I think it's simply impossible for humans to ignore mountains. Mountains were there before us, towering above us throughout human history and asking us questions from the beginning. Does it really matter if someone looks at a mountain and invokes the handiwork of God? Or if someone else looks at a mountain and sees something larger than God. Or maybe God never lived or was killed when that rock slide shifted on Katahdin. What if every sandaled prophet was simply a hiker who turned back before reaching a summit because of a lack of proper footwear and then lied about reaching the peak? Unitarian Universalists, more than anyone I know, understand the importance of spiritual journeys, long hikes with heavy soles weighting down our backpacks. We hike even when the mountains have avalanched, especially when the mountains have avalanched. My daughter in Fort Collins, Colorado, like many youths who have migrated west, sometimes refers to the Rockies perpetually in her peripheral vision as real mountains compared to Maine. But the Appalachians are older, eroded with age, and still look pretty good for being 400 million years older than the Rocky Mountains. If they weren't here, we'd miss them, with a longing that feels like an absence of love and community, like a church torn down. Which brings me to my final poem, Bicknell's Thrush. The elusive Bicknell's Thrush only breeds in high elevation spruce fir forest of the Northeast, above elevations of 3,000 feet or so. They are considered rare, and their alpine habitats are threatened with climate change. The best chance of hearing one is to climb a mountain. And the best chance of seeing one is to look for a pack of wild unicorns and then keep searching beyond that. This is Bicknell's Thrush. I told you about the Bicknell's Thrush, Catharus bicknelli, and how in my youth I hiked through pre-dawn forest to Krumholtz, stunted evergreen forests just shy of summits, listening for their stuttering love calls, three phrases with a middle phrase descending, then rising to a third phrase, as if starting down a slope, but then turning back. Never certain if I ever heard one. They're similar to other thrushes, like the gray-cheeked thrush, Catharus minimus, a bird of lowland spruce forest where their flight call is written as queer in most field guides. Breeding song in a higher pitch, a piccolo to the Bicknell's ethereal mountaintop flute. This genus, Catharus, feels cathartic, though I no longer summit easily. Come hear these other thrushes below elevations of 3,000 feet. Swainson's thrush, hermit thrush, and veery, down where the dawn air is not heady and love still abounds among conifers, love's last mountain climbed. As I mentioned, this poem is the third in a trilogy that has meaning to me, not only because I wrote them, but because I had to live them first. It turns out that we climb mountains, fall in love, and believe in spiritual somethings, not because we are guaranteed of seeing a Bicknell's thrush any more than Christians are guaranteed of seeing angels. I never expected to write about a Bicknell's thrush. Writing about a hermit thrush seemed far more likely. But sometimes a person and place can change one's mind. I've spoken a lot about myself this morning, but here's the thing. This is not really about me. It's also about you, about us. Unitarian Universalists understand that we are not promised anything, but we will definitely miss out if we don't make journeys. So keep hiking, my friends, and blessed be.